Welcome to the 112th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 16 years to the day since West Indies pulled off the highest ever fourth innings chase to win a test match, making 418 to beat Australia. Welcome to the podcast that knows all good things begin with Shiv Chandrapur.
And you were having a bit of fun actually looking at that side. It was a bit of a kind of transitional period for the West Indies, wasn't it?
I think it's what makes that victory so extraordinary is that you go back thinking, oh, this is going to be all those kind of 90s names of the West Indies who are still pretty good. And then you see sort of Darren Ganga there, you see Devon Smith, and you realise, God, they pulled off that chase with very little batting.
Ramnaresh Sarwan, the man who alongside Chandrapur would make or indeed break the next generation of West Indies cricket. So this episode of Reverse Threat Radio, the 112th episode, we are going to be looking at some of the recent cricket events, including Andy huddling under an umbrella. It's a more fun story than you'd think. We're going to be looking back to the first World Cup final, and we're going to be reviewing a quite remarkable book, actually, Steve Smith's Men, Behind Australian Cricket's Fall by Jeff. Now, we need to work out how you pronounce his surname. Do you have an idea? I don't know whether it's Lemon or Lemon. But anyway, we'll work that out later in the podcast. Anyway, it's a very good book. It's Steve Smith Men, and we're going to be reviewing it towards the end of the 112th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. Now, Andy, you got in your first day's cricket watching of the summer. And of course, like any good first day's cricket watching of the English summer, it was basked in sunshine.
Yeah, so last Wednesday I headed to the Oval for the England-Pakistan ODI, and I got one of those truly bizarre British spring afternoons that crammed in every type of weather. At one point we were seriously worried about sunburn. 10 minutes later we had a full-blown hailstorm. The hailstorm actually in its own way was quite satisfying because I was the only one of the three of us to have remembered an umbrella. Two of us managed to keep quite dry. The third of us who had boasted smugly earlier about his waterproof got soaked. So, you know, there was a certain poetic justice there. An awful lot of the day was spent sheltering behind the stands. It makes you realise that very few cricket grounds, very understandably, are really set up for that kind of weather. But we drank pale ale, ate hog roast, and pondered when the next madly optimistic pitch inspection would take place. There was at least one real jewel of a performance in the 19 overs that we got, and that was Jofra Archer. Now, there's always been plenty of hype, plenty of debate about him, and he was quite extraordinary. Just four overs, but it was pacey and close to unplayable. He took one wicket for just the six runs, and it just reminded you of that sheer pleasure of watching that kind of raw pace. The Pakistani openers just desperately pouring at the ball, you know, really struggling to get any sort of confidence going. He's got a fascinating action, comes in quite gently and then really explodes at the crease. And there was a constant buzz in the crowd every time it was his turn to bowl. I mean, you know, there are lots of great bowlers in this current England side, but there was no question at the Oval who the star attraction was.
So did you get any sense, obviously the next one day, a couple of days later down at the Rose Bowl was an absolute run fest. Not much cricket that you saw at the Oval. Did you get much of a sense of what was in store for the rest of the series beyond Jofra Archer kind of just terrorising the batsmen?
Well, I think what was surprising, actually, was seeing how well Pakistan batted a few days later. Because, as I said, based on the, as you say, very limited evidence, to be fair, at the Oval, they were really struggling with that sort of Wokes Archer opening attack. I mean, Archer, to be noted, then didn't play, actually, a few days later at the Rose Bowl. So maybe that was part of it.
But it definitely gives you a nice taste of what's in store for the World Cup across the first two games of those of that series. The one that you went to, where we saw a whole lot of raw pace, and then the run fest in the second game. It does actually get you quite excited for the World Cup coming up very shortly.
Now, on a more somber note, you have been mourning and celebrating the passing of a West Indies legend.
Yeah, so I've been reading quite a lot of the obits and then various articles and other pieces, sort of delving in the archives really to read a bit about Seymour Nurse, the West Indian cricketer who died last week. And so, as you know, as is so often the case with cricketers, when they retire, they kind of disappear into obscurity. He actually retired in the 1960s, and then it's only when they die that they actually kind of come back into the public eye. So this was a great opportunity to have a look at someone who was a slightly sort of bizarre character in many ways, in that he holds the distinction for having the highest ever test score in his final inning. So he had a double century in his final innings. And what's interesting is that he didn't retire when he was kind of, you know, in his late 30s and ready to go. He was in his mid-30s. He was at the top of his game. He'd just been named Wisden Cricketer of the Year. A couple of years later, he had made his way into that iconic West Indies team. So the middle order was Seymour Nurse, Rohan Kanai and Gary Sobers, you know, one of the greatest middle orders of all time. But having really made it, he just decided that, you know, playing international cricket wasn't really for him, and he walked away from it all at the, you know, kind of at the height of his powers, which is really interesting. And I just think one of those great reflections of the kind of range of characters that cricket can sustain within it. When he retired, he said simply, "Life has been good, and I must say I'm happy. I played for my people, and they showed me great respect." At which point he decided that, you know, he could have gone on touring the world and making big scores, but fundamentally he just wanted to be living at home, having a great time, not on the road.
Well, I think it also makes you realise that the people at the other end of the spectrum are in their own way quite bizarre. You know, the people who never get bored, those who just rack up run after run after run and will play until they're, you know, to the point of collapse. And yeah, the sport is kind of big enough to contain all of them. I guess the principle being that you'd like to think most of the people playing the game to some extent are still taking joy out of it.
From the archives. Now, we are all, as cricket fans, about to be overcome by World Cup mania, if we can get enthusiastic about another World Cup, that is. And this week, Andy is going to take us back to the very first ever World Cup final. It happened at Lord's. It happened in 1975, and there was a very unusual hat-trick.
Clive Lloyd set this game up with a sensational 100 in the first innings, and he carried West Indies to a big total of 291. Lloyd's innings was a quicker than runner ball century, which I think is now the kind of thing we accept as par for the course, but then was pretty extraordinary. But it's not the performance I want to focus on here. It's this, Lloyd's effort is really the one that I've always recollected from this final, but I want to focus on something else here. Australia respond well to the 291. They get to 81 for one. They're going at a decent rate. We've got a good final on our hands. Australian captain Ian Chappell drops the ball into the leg side and sets off straight away for a single. At the other end is Australia's highest run scorer in the tournament, Alan Turner, and he hesitates for a split second. The split second is all that Viv Richard needs. He's hurtling in from mid-off, picks up cleanly one-handed and fires in a direct hit. What's extraordinary, if you watch this a few times, it's the lack of backlift in his hand. And this is something, if any of you who've done those kind of fielding drills where you flick under one arm, you're always told, because obviously while your arm's going back, you're losing time. Seeing a master like Richard pulls it off, realise, you know, you understand that mythical thing that you're aspiring to during that drill.
It is interesting because often with fielding, there are so many actions that when you watch, you know, the real pros, we've all been on Jonty Rhodes binges on YouTube. And when you watch the real pros do it, it looks very natural and looks very simple. But there are a number of actions in the field that if you try and do them yourself, they feel incredibly ungainly. And, you know, I've tried to throw without a backlift and just flick it with the wrist, and usually it goes about 3 metres in the wrong direction. The other one is when you try to throw when your whole body's in the air and so you've got nothing kind of planted on the ground. And again, it's virtually impossible to throw with any power in the right direction. But maybe that says more about me than it says about the fielding action. But it is interesting when you reflect on these kind of moments and have tried to do the same things, exactly how much incredible kind of natural skill it takes to do these kinds of things.
And also, I think what an extraordinary sight it is. You know, I think more and more with the development of the game, I think we've all started to appreciate how key fielding is. I mean, it sounds like a strange thing to say, but I think, you know, in the 2020 format when the margins are so narrow, we've kind of appreciate it more and more. But seeing something like this does make you realise that it can be as wondrous as kind of any other aspect of the game. Now, Turner did not put in a dive, which I think is one of the things that is kind of intriguing in this, because you feel like a modern player probably would have done. But then to defend him, he may genuinely not have been aware how much trouble he was in. Such was Richard's reaction. So the Australians at that stage, 81 for 2. The Chappell brothers are then batting together. They recover to 115 for 2. Captain Ian cuts it towards backward point, and there is a clear shout of no, but the first West Indian fielder misses the ball and they begin to run. However, backing that fielder up is Richards again. He hurls it in and it's another direct hit. Richie Beno wisely opines on commentary, the old rule of never run on a misfield still holds good. And this really is the perfect example of why that maxim makes sense, because as a batsman, you rarely have a good enough view of what's happened to make an informed judgment. And that's what's happened here. It's gone through the first fielder and they haven't seen Richards very quickly onto it behind them. And that sets off great scenes at Lord's. Joyous West Indian fans pour onto the pitch. And I rather like the very laid-back crowd control of the Metropolitan Police. A couple of them wandering along and kind of politely encouraging the fans to get behind the boundary rope. None of this kind of rugby tackling that you would have maybe understandably seen now. In the words of Gideon Hay, Viv Richards is a lone figure, sauntering coolly back to his position, rolling his sleeves back up like a gunslinger holstering a six-shooter, having shot a cigarette from between a rival's lips. In other words, he's pretty happy with himself.
The other interesting thing here, you know, the other old maxim is that often direct hits are out. You know that old thing about you know, when you're watching the replay on TV, and often when it is a direct hit, it is out, because obviously you're taking away the second or 2 seconds that it takes even the very great keepers to whip the bails off as well. And that's the other thing that's the key to the skill of someone like Viv Richards in the field, is that you're getting deprived of, as a batsman, you're getting deprived of those extra seconds everywhere, you know, in terms of the direct hits coming in too.
Exactly. And I also think in both cases, one thing that perhaps I haven't made enough of is, you know, he's throwing from positions where the angle is not great. You know, he has not got a huge amount to aim at, and yet, he connects. So Australia again recover reasonably well. They get to 162 for 3. Having been involved in 2 spectacular Richards runouts, it's fair to say that Captain Ian Chappell has been warned. He confidently flicks the ball towards mid-wicket, where Richards is again on the prowl. Chappell hesitates. Richards fumbles the pickup and Chappell's goes. Richards recovers fast. In fact, he recovers so fast that the cameraman initially loses track of the ball, assuming that Richards has missed it and panning to the boundary. Rowan Kanai then points for him to throw to the striker's end. It's not clear whether Richards doesn't hear Kanai or whether he just backs himself, but he goes to the non-striker's end in an attempt to remove Australia's captain. This time it's not a direct hit, but it's fast, it's inches above the stump, and Lloyd whips off the bails in time to dismiss his fellow captain. Chappell does put in a despairing dive this time, and he's left on his knees with the shite sight of the shattered stumps in front of him. why hadn't he learnt? Why didn't he show Richards the respect that he deserved? It's interesting, because your instinct thing is to slightly despair here of the intelligence of Australia's captain. You think, surely, of all the people, you do not take another quick single to Richards. Perhaps trying to be a bit more charitable, I just wonder whether that by this point Richards' efforts have completely blown Chappell's confidence in his own calling. I mean, Chappell, to some extent, has run. It'd be quite a harsh assessment, but you could say he's run 2 of his colleagues out by this point. So it might just be that, you know, the confidence and judgment is shot by that stage. And again, you've always got to be really, really careful about drawing these links between the amateur club cricket we play and what's going on in these scenes. But, you know, I've certainly had that, when you have the sort of game where you just think, God, I've completely lost track of what a run actually is, and you start becoming very, very hesitant and cautious.
But also, it's that kind of lightning strikes, well, three times in this circumstance, isn't it? Because the fact that there were, you know, Richards puts in three fantastic pieces of fielding and they all come off. I mean, I don't know whether there were other run-out attempts from him that didn't result in run-outs. But there must be slightly something, particularly when you're pushing against the rate, where you think, I don't know whether either consciously or subconsciously, you think, well, he's had two amazing pieces of fielding. Really, is he going to pull off a third? You know, if this is the kind of thing where it needs to be an inch above the stumps in order to end up in a result, given that he looks like he's misfielded, is this going to happen again, I wonder?
But yet again, it is the old don't run off a misfield, because Richards' initial mistake is then quickly recovered, and the end is the same as the two previous times. So three of the Aussie top four removed by the fielding of Richards. Australia fight hard, but it's too much to recover from, and they're dismissed 17 runs short. Now, Clive Lloyd's spectacular century earns him the man of the match, but it's hard not to feel that Richards' performance was as decisive. Now, this hat-trick of run-outs is pretty improbable, especially for a top order in this situation. I mean, you occasionally get a spate of run-outs near the end of an innings when a team is just, you know, totally desperate. But it didn't come as a surprise to the West Indies, because they'd noticed this uncertainty in the Australian running early in the tournament, and they wanted to target it, which I guess suggests, even we're talking in the mid-70s here, you know, perhaps even a bit of the kind of video analysis that we now talk about, you know, perhaps some of that had been taking place. I have a little almost conspiracy theory here, which I confess I've found no corroborating evidence for, but I'm going to share it with you anyway, which is that I can't help wondering whether that final run out, whether that Richards fumble may all have been a bit of a ruse. I'd say that just on the basis that it's so smoothly executed for a fumble. And it works perfectly. You know, Chappell sees it supposedly go through him, and then the recovery catches him out. So there you go. Perhaps that moment that completed the hat-trick was the most spectacular of all.
It's interesting to note as well that this is an era in which teams didn't really have fielding coaches. You know, people now, cricketers now are trained to the nth degree in terms of fielding, just as they're trained as a bowler and just as they're trained as a batsman. And coaches will talk about the fact that they want their fielders to contribute a couple of wickets per innings in and of themselves. So either a spectacular catch or a spectacular run out. Whereas I think when this happened, there wasn't that same emphasis on fielding at all. And often it was simply, you know, there are fantastic fielders around, but often it was simply on the basis of natural talent. And what you're seeing here, I suppose, is natural talent to the nth degree in the way that Richards pulls off these runouts.
To the review, and for this episode we've been reading Steve Smith's Men Behind Australian Cricket's Fall by Jeff Lemon. Lemon has been covering Australian cricket since 2010, both as a broadcaster and a writer, writing for a very wide variety of magazines and publications. He's also an editor of one of Australia's oldest literary publications, Going Down Swinging, and a poet. Lemon very early on says that this book is not a detective story, by which he means it's not about uncovering every single detail of the sandpaper scandal. It's actually a far, far more ambitious book than that. It's an attempt to understand how that infamous day in Cape Town was the product of a team culture gone rotten. It has been a huge success, winner of the Wisdom Book of the Year and MCC Book of the Year already. There are an awful lot of ideas, theories put forward in this book. What struck you and has stayed with you, Toby?
Well, as you say, the range is quite remarkable, actually, from the kind of very macro level to the very micro level. And of course, the incident that sparked all of this was Sandpaper Gate. And I think Lemon's very strong on actually teasing out why it was that this became an incident that the Prime Minister of the country felt compelled to comment on in the end, and the different factors that made that up, given that ball tampering is a thing that's happened in cricket. We've seen examples of it in the past. We've even seen the opposing captain in that Australia-South Africa series be fined for it at a different time. And Lemon unpacks some of the aspects behind this, one of which is around the, you know, this cultural thing that Australia were relishing the moral high ground at the time, and, you know, were constantly accusing their opponents of cheating effectively, and always saying that they were the people who knew where the line was. There's a wonderful chapter talking about the line and all the quotations about the line, and, you know, you could go up to the line and headbutt the line indeed, but you wouldn't cross the line.
Well, it made you realise it was one, the line had become one of two things. It would either become this sort of PR thing that Australian cricket players seemed to be just briefed to talk about the line, or almost more disturbingly, it seemed to have become a sort of almost religious thing.
It was a cult.
It was like you could do anything as long as you referenced the holy line.
Exactly. So there was part of the fact that Australia, you know, had this moral high ground with and were the keepers of the holy line. The other points that Lemon makes about the incident itself is firstly that it was just embarrassingly bad. You know, the way that it was the way that it was hidden. There was a kind of certain incompetence to that kind of ball tampering. Professional cricketers, he makes the point, actually spend quite a lot of their time working out how to manipulate the ball in various ways, and this just seemed a bit schoolboyish in many ways. And then the other aspect of it was that whereas in the past, you know, mints you could legitimately have in your pocket to be sucking a mint while you're, you know, standing out in the field, and, you know, you could bite the ball as Shahid Afridi did because you've always got teeth on you, or you could use the zipper on your belt. This was the first time that someone had actually brought sandpaper onto the pitch in order to, or brought a sort of foreign object onto the pitch in order to use it, and that these were the things that actually made this a distinctive moment, but more so actually was the culture within which this particular incident sat.
And there are so many different angles, I guess, to the culture. There's one figure who I think is we're given a kind of mini biography of and revealed an awful lot about what had gone wrong, which was David Warner. And I think one thing that makes Lemon's account so credible is that this is not a hatchet job. You know, he is tough on Warner, but he's also sympathetic and empathetic when he needs to be. I think there's this interesting balance. So he talks about the way Warner was used and encouraged to be the team's attack dog. And there's this extraordinary thing, and it shows you how much you forget in a small time, that once after Du Plessis had described the Australians as like a pack of dogs, Warner then literally barked him off the field. And you thought, how did we not at that point think this had all gone completely insane? Mm-hmm. But then, you know, Lemon's quite understanding because he sort of says, well, you've made Warner out to be that person. You've actively encouraged him to have that role. So why don't we then be more understanding of the inevitable consequences, which he then gets consumed by that role?
Exactly, and certainly, as you say, Lemon isn't one of these people, of whom there are many, who say that, you know, David Warner is fundamentally a stupid bully. He has a much more nuanced approach to Warner than that. There is actually quite a moving description, a whole lot of background that I hadn't actually realised, which was around Warner's partner and the treatment of Warner's partner during
this. This is Candice Warner.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Who actually... goes on to have a miscarriage, you know, shortly after this series, perhaps because of all of the, you know, stress around it and the very personal abuse that she was subjected to around this as well, because of some things in her past too. And the other thing is that Warner is also fitting into, it's interesting, when Warner's not in the team, it seems that other people are allocated to take on that Warner role. So just as someone's, you know, allocated to be the keeper or field at short leg, Australia had actually developed this culture where someone was allocated the role of being chief, you know, attack dog in the words of the in the words of Lemon.
And the point is, not only were they allocated that role, there was then no accountability for going beyond or close to this fictional line. And Lemon references the good bloke doctrine. So selection was based on whose personality made them comfortable rather than those who deserved reward. And this, so he talks about players like Ed Cowan, for example, who were quickly discarded for being sort of independent of mind.
He reads books,
yeah. And this idea that the good bloke doctrine is extremely dangerous because it involves, oh well, it's unfair on players who've done well and not got picked. But it's also dangerous because it prizes a certain form of behaviour that doesn't necessarily create a team culture that actually works.
And so then the broader sort of, you know, so we started off with the sandpaper gate itself. You look more broadly at the team, but then the broader context that Lemon puts all of this within is around Cricket Australia and the culture of Cricket Australia. And there's a wonderful few lines in which he really summarizes this, which I'll quote now. So he says, at its upper levels, Cricket Australia has developed a culture where aggression isn't just tolerated, it's encouraged, where accountability isn't just lax, it's eliminated, where enemies are created and the culprits rewarded. The Cricket Australia of the last few years has been abrasive, selfish, and immune from consequence. It would have been a miracle if its cricket team had been anything else. So do you think that it's a kind of convincing narrative to say that this incident and the culture in the team was, in a sense, inevitable because of the broader Cricket Australia culture?
I think the connection, that particular connection, is made quite late on. So for an awful lot of the book, we focused on the team. But I agree that it's really compelling when Lemon then steps back and says, well, hang on, let's go beyond the team. Let's look at everyone else. Let's look at the board. And it's incredibly damning. And I think, you know, this is where, like, I guess all the great cricket books, it goes way beyond the sports. And you talk about how an organisation just loses its way and how values are sort of spread throughout. I think it's a triumph as a piece of analysis, because there's so many of these stories and incidents that you know, that you're familiar with, but you've never seen them threaded together in this way, and suddenly it's a very convincing and coherent picture. But it's also a very powerful polemic, because it makes you realise, you know, quite what these people did to the game of cricket and what they did to a nation that, you know, I know a lot of people, that there was then a bit of a pushback, wasn't there, that, you know, were we all too hysterical about this? But in truth, Lemon makes this point that cricket fans want to believe in cricket as something more and something special, and we almost shouldn't punish cricket fans for their idealism in that, and to some extent we should look to the players to live up to that.
So two particularly noteworthy things about this book, I think, are the fact that it's, you know, it's written by someone who's got a real flair for writing. It is a joy to read. It's pacey, it's full of interesting narrative, and it's well constructed, and so I think actually it's a pleasure to read. Possibly the very best thing about this book, and this sounds like it's damning with faint praise, but it's not, because it's bloody amazing, is the cover. Because the cover has on it, in the Steve Smith's Men is the title of the book, and those words on the cover, big bold all capital words, are actually sort of embossed with a sandpaper effect, which I just think is a marvelous little touch, and good on the publisher for actually forking out to pay for that to be put on the cover of every single one of these books. So that is Jeff Lemon's Steve Smith's Men Behind Australian Cricket's Fall, which I think will actually go down as a bit of a classic. It's tied very much to a particular moment, but it's, as Andy says, it's a much broader look at cricket and cricket culture. And that was the 112th episode of Reverse Whip Radio.